Rich Kimble here with Kerry Haskell. And on the telephone, the guy who kicks off the 5 o'clock hour for us every week, writer Colin Fleming. Hello, Colin.
What's up, hard-rocking Rich Kimble?
Well, we're looking forward to going back in time with you. And I was looking at some of the albums we're going to be talking about today. It's such a strange year. 69, 70, 71, to me, those 3 years are sort of their own little era. Not quite the 60s, not quite the 70s. And the array of albums and successful songmakers that out there kind of illustrates that. It was a special time in music.
Interregnum period of much transition and a very melty potty kind of period as well, too, because you do not have prevailing movements, really. Psychedelia is all done. You have a lot of folk music. You have a lot of conceptual music. You have progressive music, progressive rock. You have people from the 1950s coming back more powerfully even than they were in their first go-round. So you have a lot of melange stuff going on at once. Yes, I would agree with that.
Well, let's start with the debut album from Led Zeppelin, an album that surprisingly only saw one single release, Good Times, Bad Times, but of course, much of the album has achieved classic status through the years.
They certainly didn't do much with singles. They were never a singles band, and singles were also coming to an end in a sense during this period. Now, I think Zeppelin is the Jonathan Tays of classic rock. I think they are wildly overrated, and yet I know others feel certainly differently. But were I to make my Zeppelin-based case that they were not overrated, I would lean towards this first album before they decide to have endless tracks and pretend they were Gandalf or whatever else was going on. This one is pretty much the live set, which is left over from the Yardbirds, another transition kind of period for that band with Keith Relf going off and Robert Plant coming in, Jimmy Page remaining the constant. It's basically their live set in the studio. And I like albums like that because you get that energy of in-concert performance. The Beatles did this with Please Please Me. It's not really what we think of as a Beatles album. We wouldn't get that until with the Beatles, where you're getting production value in the studio. You're basically getting, okay, boys, let's run through what we do and pretend there are rows of people in front of you. And that's what Zeppelin did. And I think their playing is at its highest level on this album. John Bonham is, to me, oftentimes a 16-year-old's idea of a great drummer. I think there were drummers, certainly, that could drum circles around him. He was nowhere near at the level of a Keith Moon. And though technically proficient, I think he had none of Ringo Starr's feel for a drum kit and what that could do in service to a song. But he is at his best on this album as well. And Jimmy Page is not overdoing it with the guitar overdubbing at this juncture.
Also, a bit more bluesy and truer to their roots than some of those later albums.
Yes, bluesy, and the blues is such a wonderful American musical idiom because it underpins everything from garage music to psychedelia to lots of jazz to heavy metal. And it's interesting to note that I think Charlie Parker and Jimmy Page, and for that matter Bach, would have common grounds in terms of the blues and what the function of the bass was in blues. There's a lot in common between Zeppelin at times and Bach. There really is. And that's kind of a strange pairing. And yet this was, like you said, very true to their blues roots. And it has a feral quality that they would dispense with later and become really too fussy, too mannered, too rush-like. You want to have that blend of finesse and spontaneity. And I think this is as close as Zeppelin got to having that combination.
While early 69 saw the arrival of Led Zeppelin, it was a departure for the band Cream.
Right. They were on their way out. They were kind of like, we're doing sports analogies, like the Celtics, right? They didn't like each other, and they were going to break up. And they did not know exactly how to do this. They wanted to have an album along the lines of 1968's Wheels of Fire, where it was half studio and half live. Cream was a very schizoid kind of band. You could get something eminently popish in the studio, and then you could get the 35-minute jam on the concert stage, where it could be great some nights, other nights it could be anything but great. And one thing that was interesting to me was when I first was getting into music like this, and I was reading one of those Rolling Stone album guides, it said something along the lines of, like, if you were really hardcore about music around, like, 1966 or 1967, you listened to the Stones and the Who and the Beatles and everything, but you got really geared up for somebody, a band like Cream, because you had these virtuosic players, and it was so cutting edge, and they were so confident. They take their name from the idea of being the cream of the crop, which is just appealing hubris, if that's not an oxymoron. And the album certainly has its moments where it smokes in the live cuts, and you have a wonderful touching number almost in Clapton's Badge with an assist from George Harrison. And these two were collaborating a lot at the time. And fun fact, not a lot of people know this, that when Clapton played guitar on the Beatles' While My Guitar Gently Weeps the year before, he gave Harrison his guitar after he was done. So when you listen to that guitar duel at the end of Abbey Road with the end, and you hear those passages that Harrison's playing, he is playing the guitar that Clapton used that gave him from While My Guitar Gently Weeps. So yeah, schizophrenic album, but really one that, I don't know, it seems to work. It's one of those things that shouldn't work, that manages to work despite its contrasting halves.
Also in 1969, a new album from the Velvet Underground, the group a bit remade. Lou Reed, of course, still there, but John Cale had left.
Right, and that is one of the, well, it's probably the most polarizing, I would say, Velvet Underground album, because you have something like Some Kind of Love and Pale Blue Eyes, and Pale Blue Eyes especially, it's a beautiful love song. It's really one of the most beautiful love songs of the 1960s, which is enough to say that a song is among the most beautiful love songs of its decade, but there were some doozy love songs that decade. We're talking Beach Boys, we're talking Kinks and Waterloo Sunset, we're talking Here, There, and Everywhere by the Beatles, and this one is right up there. At the same time, on the same side, you have the mega riff monster that is What Goes On, and there's a live version from The Matrix of What Goes On. And I like reading YouTube comments because they're often written better than what so-called professional writers write. And this one person was listening to like the 28-minute version of What Goes On, and they said, I am now in my living room dry humping the furniture to this riff. And I thought, you know what, that's like really appropriate, because it sounds like, if that was going to be an interest of yours, something you would wish to have soundtrack that interest. And there's the very strange song, really collage, the murder mystery that doesn't quite work. You have the smoking guitar solo and beginning to see the light. You have Jesus of all things, which sounds like proto-spiritualized. And again, it's just this hubbub of activity, of so many different strands of music happening at once. And I like that idea, because oftentimes now you'll hear from people and say something like publishing, that if something is not all one thing, they don't get it. Like, it has to be all funny or all serious. And that's not how life is. And I think the best music and the best art has that kind of life quotient, that mix. And this album certainly fits that bill.
Oh, Colin Fleming talking music from early 1969 with us here on Downtown. Few albums start as boldly as MC5's Kick Out the Jams, so boldly that it got edited, it got banned in places, and they weren't very happy about some of the work the record company did.
Ha! Let me see a sea of hands, Kimball, right? That's pretty great, that album. These talk about a church-like proselytizing between songs. You could take the music off of this live album by the MC5, the Motor City Five, they're from Detroit, and just play the in-between song comments. And the introduction. The introduction is one of the great rousing, rallying cries in all of recorded sound. If that doesn't pump you up, then, well, you're in a really bad spot in life, and you might have to listen to it again. But it is very adrenalized, and it was a controversial album, of course, because the exhortation isn't just to kick out the jams. It's to kick out the jams, you certain Oedipal followers, let us say. And it's just one riff after another coming at you, and it is so raw. And the album title and the song title all of these bands would come through Detroit, these English bands. And in the view of the MC5, they would not be trying hard enough to win over this hardcore Detroit crowd. So their directive would be to kick out the jams. That was their rallying cry slash directive. And, well, they certainly applied it to themselves pretty ruthlessly on this record.
Also coming out around that same time, following up on his big comeback special on NBC, Elvis headed on down to Memphis, got together with Chips Moman at American Sound, and produced one of his best albums from Elvis in Memphis.
He's so good. It's one of the best albums, period. There are some times that I'm not sure that it's not the best album of the decade. And to say that Elvis made better music, perhaps, at the end of the 1960s than he did in the mid to late 1950s is kind of a shocking claim, but I think that there's some merit in it. Even when I listen to, like, the Sun recordings, it's mind-blowing how modernistic that still sounds. It sounds like the music of the future, like the Tomorrowland, Disney World, is the, like, world of tomorrow. This sounds like the music of tomorrow still. And so he already had that in his back catalog, and here he goes down to Memphis, and he's marrying up the blues. Again, there's the notion of blues with gospel music straight from the church, kind of rhythm and blues, which is different from the blues, and you hear it, like, right from Wearing That Loved On Look. He is in such fine voice that if you were a singer, you'd have to hear this and be like, oh, come on, man, I can't compete with that. That's Frank Sinatra once said condescendingly that if Elvis wanted to try, he could be like a good singer. Please. He's a much better, just going by this record, he's a better singer than Sinatra. He has better breath control. He has more power in the voice. He has more range in the voice. And he had these theatrical moments, too. Like, he could do something at the beginning of a song like Long Black Limousine, which is almost like Mystery Train grown up into adulthood.
Yeah.
And he could have this sort of, like, fake intro that he does also during the Sun sessions on Baby Let's Play House, right?
Right.
He does that just to show you, like, look, I can just trot out this display of my vocal chops, and I can start all over again. I can be even better with this dirge that you're going to ironically wish to dance to. And it's a 12-bar blues, but he turns it into something that's not loping, and something that instead strides, like, manfully into this future where Elvis always seemed, when he was making his best music, to live. It's a fascinating recording.
Yeah, a great cover of a song that Chuck Jackson had. I think it was a Bacharach David song, Any Day Now. Of course, Mac Davis is in the ghetto, but it was, to me, it was the sound of a guy free from the kernel, if only for a moment, because he didn't have to do another god-awful movie soundtrack.
It's a thick slab of sound. Now, to be fair to some of those movie soundtracks, if you go back and listen to something like Potluck, there are such winners on there that I, for a long time, didn't hear because I looked away from that stuff because it's just kind of the catch-all dismissal it gets that you should avoid this. But it was never really as bad as I think those histories make it out to be, and you can find really worthwhile music. And I would listen to Elvis sing anything, but with Any Day Now that you mentioned, we get that country infusion. He was a big country person, and we're hearing that in True Love Travels on a Gravel Road, which is something that, right from its title, sounds like Dylan could have written in his Nashville period. And so you have Elvis trying to throw his weight in there with the big boys, the heavies, the album makers in the post-single world. And he is more than holding his own.
And then finally, a bunch of guys from the San Francisco area playing swamp rock. Born on the Bayou, Proud Mary, all making up CCR's second album, Bayou Country.
Proud Mary is such a shockingly mature and successful piece of writing. And I think Fogerty was 23 years old when he wrote it, and he had been making music for a while, and he had never written a song close to that level, and that was kind of the aha breakthrough moment for him, right from the first chord, which he was basing off of Beethoven, right? The Fifth Symphony. He wanted that kind of chord that just said, behold, this is going to be a big deal. And he hit all the right licks, as Big Bill Brunzi once sang. He hit them right in the Proud Mary, Keep On Rolling, Rolling in the River. That's just like a line that feels good as syllables in your head to replay. And the band, was a band that, as you said, could do this sort of Slim Harpo swamp rock, and they could speed up the tempo, and you could have an album closer like Keep on Chuglin', which is just pure sort of Booker T groove. Certain songs, certain musics are just able to hit a groove that nobody else is really able to hit. Like, if you listen to something by the Beatles like Soldier of Love from their BBC sessions, that Arthur Alexander song, there comes a moment after the first verse where they go into the chorus where it's like, oh, yeah, they just hit the groove. They have that groove. And CCR had that, too. And this was one of three albums. People used to work a lot harder back then. They released in 1969, but it's like one of the ones that cements their status as a big deal, a contender for the best ever American band with the Beach Boys, the Byrds, and the Velvet Underground, between probably those four.
And created the bane of existence for 50 years of bar bands who had to have drunk patrons yell at them, "Proud Mary!"
I think a lot of people have had a lot of drinks to songs like Proud Mary and barbecues and everything and getting a little lubricated out there on the boat and 4th of July. And it's funny because Fogerty was a satirist almost in some of his writing. And anytime he mentions rain in the song, which he does a lot, that's sort of his code word for things are not really so great right here. We should probably address that. But they're so tuneful, these songs. He's a great artist with melody. Brian Wilson was that way. Ray Davies was that way. I mentioned Here, There, and Everywhere. Just the melody. McCartney, just great at melody. And Fogerty is certainly in that camp, I would say, too.
Absolutely. Well, a great selection of albums. Go revisit them. Check them on out. And, of course, go to Colin's website at colinflemminglit.com. Colin, thank you as always. We'll see you again next week.
I have to do a shout-out first.
Please do.
I have to. So you are a blog reader, and you know about my little protege, my neighbor.
Yes,
my
Emma.
Writer friend, Emma, yes. And she is a very talented young woman and actually has ability to write really well. So we go to the Starbucks and I help her with that. And tomorrow she has a birthday. So I want to say happy birthday, Emma Perez, a.k.a. BFE, because she would get a kick out of that.
We'll share that as well. Thank you, Colin. And congratulations, Emma, on yet another one.
All right. I'll see you, my friend.
Thanks, Colin.